The last couple of years I have talked about Kierkegaard, and I'm just talking 3 days this time, today, Friday, and Saturday. So if you want a more extensive treatment of Kierkegaard by me, in the tape library, I think we have either 5 sessions or 6 sessions on Kierkegaard, and it's probably called Stages on Life's Way, wherein I talk about Kierkegaard's 3 stages of his doctrine of the 3 stages of psychological development done in the context of Kierkegaard's own life. In these days, I won't be talking about Kierkegaard's life, but I'll simply be presenting his doctrine of the 3 stages and applying it. And the thought occurred to me this morning as I was looking over some of my notes about Kierkegaard's reaction to the philosophic age that came before, prior to him, how very similar it sounded like the American colonists rebelling against at least what they saw as the repressive laws of Great Britain, which deprived them of their freedom. Since the American dream is the dream of as much freedom for as many people as possible, and since existentialism is oriented to the basic concept of freedom, I suspect that there are a lot of crossovers back and forth that we can notice. I've learned by a long experience at Holden Village that what tends to happen in this room, and I don't know why it is, but the brain power tends to be rather generally diffused. It is not concentrated in one spot. And so consequently, I am very open if someone has some brilliant insight or idea, you know, if they toss it in as we go along. Because oftentimes it's much more worth listening to or talking about than what I might happen to have in mind at the moment. So, you know, I run a relaxed ship. We get to the shore anyway, even though all the shrouds aren't as tight as they might be. And, you know, so feel free to jump in if you don't understand something I said, or if you disagree with me, or if you have some insight that you think might be useful for your own reading in Kierkegaard, if you'd like to read some more Kierkegaard. I think probably about the best thing I know of a primary text sort to cut your teeth on Kierkegaard is an anthology, which just happens to be in the bookstore, called Kierkegaard. And I think the editor is a man named Bretall, B-R-E-T-A-L-L. I know it's Princeton University Press. Happens to be the first book on Kierkegaard, which was printed in the United States, you know, an English translation. And it's still in print, which tells you something about the quality of the book. And I think I got my copy of it in probably about 1955, and it had been in print 4 or 5 years then. You know, so 4 books nowadays, that's a pretty long longevity for a long-haired type book. But it contains selections from a lot of Kierkegaard's writings at various periods during his life, and it also gives you a kind of running history of his life and a comment on the selections which are there, which usually are pretty good. There are some that I think leave a bit to be desired. But anyway, you can read around in there and kind of enjoy yourself with Kierkegaard. Okay, Kierkegaard, philosophically speaking, is a reaction not only against Hegel, but is a reaction against a kind of approach to life which systematizes, organizes, and explains everything. Because one of the things that Kierkegaard was concerned to argue was that reality has a surprising amount of openness to it. There's a surprising amount of freedom to it. And one of the characteristics of freedom is that it's inexplainable. It can't be accounted for. Anything which can be accounted for is not free. And certainly if it's predictable, it's not free. Well, Hegel had purported to come up with a method whereby you not only could understand the present, but you could predict the future, and you could explain prehistory. You could go back farther than we know and explain what happened back then. As a result of Hegel and the Hegelian method, we today have geology, you know, which talks in terms of what happened a million years ago on the earth with great confidence, and so on. Hegel seems to have been applied more successfully with the past than with the future. And I sometimes, being as a typical philosopher, being very irreverent about most claims to knowledge, I sometimes suspect that we have been more successful with prehistory than with predicting the future, because prehistory is unverifiable. But the future isn't.
What was that word, prehistory? What?
Unverifiable. In other words, nobody can prove you're wrong. See, but the future can trip you up. So, be real careful in deciding what happened at this time, that time, or the other. Well, at any rate, Kierkegaard argued that Hegel and the philosophic tradition which led up to Hegel had encapsulated the very essence of freedom, namely spirit, and had subjected it to matter. Now, a basic doctrine in Hegel was that the energy sources in the universe are ideas. Ideas are what energizes matter and causes history to occur. But in the process, the ideas enter into matter and get concretized. Well, quite obviously, if you get concretized, you know, as any victim of a racketeer can tell you, this pretty well immobilizes you. And so he argued that what was wrong with Hegel was that Hegel started out with the idea of a dynamic universe, but he froze it. And all freedom is gone in Hegel. There's no, you know, everything is the victim of the system. And so consequently, he argued that the way it really is that there's freedom and there must be freedom. In other words, he made the cause of freedom a moral issue. Not just simply said Hegel's wrong, this is the way it really is, but he argued freedom is the essence of what it is to be alive. And so consequently, we must live in freedom. And the essence of freedom is spontaneity, which is another way of saying unpredictability. Can't be explained by the system. The essence of freedom is spontaneity. Well, what this means ethically, then, is that one must constantly decide what he's going to do, because he can't go to the system. And another thing which follows from this is the essence of freedom is to be shaping the future. Now, one of the things I think you'll notice as we're going along the next 3 days is to what a great extent Kierkegaard has had an effect on producing the kind of place that Holden Village is. Now, I'm not going to comment on it, but I'm sure you'll notice that. And I suspect you'll find as we go along also that Kierkegaard explains a great deal of the age in which we live. And as we go along, all of a sudden you'll say, oh yeah, I see. You know, oh yeah, I see what you mean there. I see what he means there. Yeah, all of a sudden certain things make sense about life as we have it today that perhaps didn't make sense before. Okay, so at any rate, the essence of freedom is to be shaping the future. And for this to be the case, the reality must be not logical, as almost 2,000 years of thought had claimed it was, but paradoxical. In other words, it has to go beyond the capacity to reduce it to doctrine. So experience is always open. There's always novelty. To kind of pick up on something Vern was talking about this morning, for Kierkegaard, I suspect that the essence, although for Kierkegaard essence is a dirty word, but the essence of experience is the miraculous. The miraculous is not the unusual, but the typical.
The essence of experience.
And it's a miracle. Every moment's a miracle. There's an openness about it. There's a uniqueness about it. You know, one of the characteristics of a miracle is that it's unique. You know, if we change water into wine every half hour, it wouldn't be a miracle.
Yes.
See?
Well,
and so consequently,
that, we do not experience anything that isn't miraculous.
Yeah.
But everything we actually experience must be miraculous, or we wouldn't experience it.
No, you're starting to sound like predecessors of Kierkegaard. you're doing a logical conversion there, see? You're converting a proposition.
Oh, I turn this back on my illogic.
So you have to become paradoxical, Paul. All right. So at any rate, there's a certain openness and there's a certain freedom to reality itself, and so consequently, the way we live has to have the same kind of freedom. And to, you know, kind of tie into the American experience, I suspect that had they been Kierkegaardian existentialists at the time, rather than whatever they might have happened to have been, I suspect they might have argued to George III rather than on Lockean principles of government. They might have argued to George III that the nature of reality being the way it is necessary for people in a new world where there's even more openness than in the old world to be freed of all the order, organization, shackles, and so on, of an alien culture, and to shape their own future and their own destiny. Because not to function that way is to function unsuccessfully. Now, Kierkegaard concerned himself in his entire life with the question, really, of how can life be lived successfully? And if you understand it wrong, if you live it wrong, you run into problems. At the same time, there are certain kinds of stages that people go through. Now, there are three stages, which Kierkegaard talked about, and there are kind of intermediate points, and this is what I'll primarily focus on these 3 days. But not everybody gets to the third stage. Not everybody gets to the second stage. Many people never get beyond the first stage, which is the stage at which they begin existence. And you know, one of the interesting spin-offs from our discussion in the next 3 days is you can psychoanalyze yourself and other people and decide at what stage of development they've gotten to. You know, it's even more fun to psychoanalyze the next guy. Well, you know, he's only at the aesthetic stage, so of course he behaves like an ass. You know, that sort of thing, see. All right. Well, at any rate, the first stage is the aesthetical stage. Now, the word aesthetic, which we tend in the English-speaking world to restrict to the world of appreciation of the arts and so on. You know, and we have courses in aesthetics and so on. But the word aesthetic or aesthetical means relating to the senses and feelings. And so it's the whole world of sensation. Kierkegaard called his first stage the aesthetical stage, simply because it is a kind of life, a kind of lifestyle, where one's goal is to satisfy one's senses and feelings. In a sense, it's sort of like a traditional approach to ethics, which we call hedonistic, or where the ultimate principle is the pleasure principle. Except that, you know, you can get pleasure in a lot of kinds of ways, and, you know, some people get pleasure from thinking, which is certainly not a sense-related kind of activity. And so one has to be careful with that word pleasure. But Kierkegaard said that all human beings begin on the aesthetical level. The function of their life is to satisfy their desires, to avoid pain, achieve pleasure. Begins with the little infant who cries when he's dry on one end or wet at the other, right? And then when he gets fed or when he gets changed, then he's quiet. And for a period of time, oftentimes for a longer period of time, His whole life is oriented around satisfaction and avoidance of pain. And that's his whole existence. Now, if a life is oriented around either pain avoidance or the achievement of a particular pleasure, quite obviously, if we deal with the psychological faculties as Kierkegaard did in the Kantian tradition of the big three of reason, will, and emotion, what is primary here is emotion. In other words, we are emotionally oriented, or we are affectively oriented. The function of will is to see to it that the emotions get what they want. The function of reason is to figure out how to get it. So both reason and will become ancillary to the emotions. The individual lives for his or her momentary impulses, desires. If they change, and the orientation of the individual changes, and so it goes. One of the paradoxical things about the English language is that when we encounter a human being who lives this way, you know, and is constantly flitting from this thing to that thing, and we say they don't know what they want, what do we call them? We call them willful. Well, they're not really willful, they're emotionful or something like that, see, because their will is not strong, it's not predominant, it's working for their impulses, for what they want. Well, our passions set the goal. Will seeks to achieve it, and by means of what reason has figured out, one can achieve. Now, it's perfectly possible for a human being to live his or her entire life this way. And many people do. Many people never get beyond this stage. It is a kind of stage where the human being is self-centered, where ultimately everything the individual does has some kind of ego satisfaction involved in it, and it can get extremely sophisticated. And one can undertake, you know, extremely complex kinds of activities. For instance, I'll give you an example of a very complex activity. About 10 years ago, Truman Capote, who is a beautiful example of an aesthetic person who has not gotten beyond that stage, threw a party, I think it was at the Waldorf Astoria in New York, and they converted the grand ballroom into looking like what Americans think a Turkish Sultan's harem looks like. And he had about 500 of America's beautiful people, you know, as his guests at the party, and everybody had fantastic costumes, and they drank champagne bubbling out of fountains, and all kinds of strange and exotic sort of things went on. And Truman, of course, the party was covered by the international press, and Truman was interviewed extensively. I think for a year he must have gotten kicks out of the experience. And he said he had spent 3 years planning the event, planning about a five-hour experience. Well, this is a beautiful example of a complicated aesthetical event. Well, this kind of a lifestyle has certain kind of obvious characteristics. For instance, one of the characteristics which it has is it is non-historical. Because it is a kind of life which is oriented to present moments. And it is a life which is made up of a large or small number of present moments. And the individual just kind of drifts from one present moment to the next present moment. Now there may be a little anticipation which gives a little bit of a future sense. And there may be a little afterglow which gives a little past to that individual's kind of experience, but by and large, it's a kind of a jumping from present moment kind of existence. And a kind of indifference to history, except as history gets in the way of what one wants to achieve in a given moment. And for a moment to be successful, it has to be detached from history. It has to be a kind of like a unique experience. And so consequently, what you do to achieve the moment is you divorce yourself from the ongoing flow of events to achieve the moment. Now, whether, you know, you convert the ballroom to the Waldorf Astoria to a never-never land that has no historical connections at all in reality, or whether you go to a mountaintop for a mountaintop type experience, you know, or whatever it may be, it's divorced from history. And so it's a kind of life which is lived sort of independent of the ebb and flow of history. Obviously, then, it's a kind of life which requires, you know, a certain amount of financial resources. And most of us can't afford to live outside of history, because it costs money to be detached from the historical process and to carry out this kind of a life. Paul,
oh,
you had a question?
You used the word afterglow pertaining to past hedonistic experience. Some people use the word hangover.
Well, no, a hangover wouldn't be an afterglow. It would be just the opposite of an afterglow. But a hangover is a good example of history spoiling the experience. See, and it takes away some of the pleasure of the experience, because the experience has a past. It, like a comet's tail, the hangover trails after the event. So consequently, if you're a good aesthete, what you attempt to do is to have kinds of experiences that don't have hangovers. See, you want to throw a party in such a way that you don't wake up the next morning and you got to empty the ashtrays and pick up the empty bottles, and there aren't any cigarette burns on the dining room table.
You want to continue the glow?
You might. It depends. But you know, you kind of float on it for a little bit, and then it kind of peters out, because you can't control it, you know, it controls itself. And then you start working toward the next experience. I suppose in a sense it's like surfing. You know, and each one of these moments is another wave.
It's like a continuous vitamin.
Well, it's not continuous, but it's serial, one after another. Now, there also will tend to be a pattern, you know, where it might build up to peak kind of experiences, you know, may go ups and downs, or you may have a series of experiences that, you know, have aesthetical value, but you're not getting many kicks out of them anymore, and so you shift around to do something else.
To do away with this deflated feeling.
Oh yeah.
You've got to have something.
Oh sure, yeah, and so you look for something new. Sometimes. Now, drugs may come in a number of ways. Now, drugs will tend to come in relation to this kind of a life, as opposed to the next two that we'll be talking about. They may tend to come in a number of ways. They may come in as a stimulant in order to make a given planned experience more exciting. And we talk about being on a high. See, that means that you heighten the experience, or you heighten your capacity to have the experience. Secondly, you may have drugs to create an experience.
Is that because you lack, you're only fit for the first stage and not for the other stages that you're going to talk
about? No, you will move on to the next stage when this stage is no longer able to satisfy you. Now, you may reach a point before you go on to the next stage where you turn to drugs or other sorts of things in order to, you know, to work you up again. You know, you've gotten pretty jaded and beat out and so on, and you may turn to drugs to to get some more kicks out of this stage. Now you may turn to drugs to heighten your capacity to have experiences of this sort. You may turn to drugs to create experiences of this sort, like Coleridge seeing the Pleasure Palace of Kubla Khan. Of course, the Pleasure Palace of Kubla Khan poem, or Kubla Khan, you know, is a beautiful example of an aesthetical poem, you know, of this stage kind of existence. Or you may turn to drugs to forget.
Because you can't tolerate
this, and you don't know any other kind of life.
Because you don't want to be attached to history.
Oh yeah, sure. You know, it's like nirvana. Nirvana in a capsule. This is why also people who are unable to handle this stage and having an alternative to it oftentimes sleep a lot and are tired. You know, these are ways of withdrawing from this life, but also, and I'll talk about that right at the end of the day, also avoiding moving on to the next stage. Because one of the things you do not want to do at this stage is commit yourself to anything. Because if you commit yourself to anything, you tie yourself down for the future.
Is this why you become a parasite and lean on somebody else and pull them down with you? Or are you able to take it alone?
Well, if you're a parasite, you wouldn't be deliberately a parasite. Because to be a parasite, among other things, involves incurring obligations. Now, you do not want to incur obligations, because as soon as you have incurred an obligation, you are at the next stage, which is the ethical stage. And that you want to avoid. You want to remain pre-ethical. As long as you can. Pardon? Oh yeah, sure, because you don't want any attachment. Any kind of permanence is antithetical to whatever you believe in, what you exist for. So your whole lifestyle is anti being tied down. In addition to which, you do have to be free to move around, drift, and so on, for the simple reason that psychologically, when you experience an emotion for at least a temporary period of time, you are incapable of experiencing it again. It just sort of drains. This is the whole theory behind Aristotle's notion of the theater as catharsis, where you go and have the experience of the tragic. You get overwhelmed by it, you get terrified at existence, you weep and wail as a member of the audience, and then you go out of the theater and you're no longer scared to live because you have experienced those feelings of terror and they're gone and you can't feel them for a while. All right, this whole life is based on feelings and on feeling satisfaction. Well, you use up your feelings and then they got to get recharged. And that's why you go through blah periods. And after you've had a very exciting experience, you know, all of a sudden life is gray for a while. Not only might you have a hangover, but everything is just kind of nothing. Now, you may have an afterglow period where the sun, you know, the sunset of the previous experience still leaves it looking kind of glorious. But then it gets kind of dull and prosaic. Now, we Americans, you know, I mentioned you got to have money to live at this stage. Now, we Americans, since World War II, have been able to live this way. Up until the Arabs tightened up the spigot, see? And there are an awful lot of Americans who have never known any life other than this one, and who really got uptight in the last decade. When all of a sudden it started getting taken away from them. You know, and so we have riots and, you know, and you gotta go in an army and go to Vietnam, and that takes away your freedom from you and all sorts of other sorts of things, you know, and so you get rebellion against losing the aesthetic of life. But the Eisenhower years were the great aesthetical years of the American people. All of a sudden, all of us could afford to buy shrimp, houses, automobiles. You know, and some of us can remember the 30s when, you know, if you saved real hard, you could afford a Model T or a Model A. But you couldn't get beyond that. Well, those days are starting to come back again, aren't they? Where we're almost at the point that the automobile is the rich man's vehicle again. You know, and the rest of us drive around and use cars at best. See, well, when you have a period of time when a nation can afford to indulge itself and orient itself to the pleasure principle, then you get an aesthetical stage. And it has, you know, the characteristics we've been talking about. And then when it starts getting cut off, what happens? Well, you don't want it. The little kid doesn't want you to pull a sucker out of his mouth, does he? And he fights to hang on to his sucker, and he makes a scene because he wants his sucker. You know, you take his pacifier away from him, and he doesn't want that taken away from him. Well, what tends to happen either is that times change for the individual or the society, and the aesthetical state cannot continue any longer, or it gets to hang out. And the individual begins to think there must be more to life than this. Life gets dull. You get bored. By the way, do you know what aesthetical people do when they get bored? What does Truman Capote do? I mean, other than write novels. Well, his last novel is a good example of what I'm talking about. What do? They gossip. Right? They make up nasty things about one another. You know, whether it's Truman Capote and the beautiful jet set, you know, a bunch of wealthy butterflies, or whether it's the court of Louis XIV who had nothing to do and were fabulously wealthy off of the peasants of France, you know, they all behave the same way. You develop more and more extravagant ways of having pleasure. You know, the wigs get higher and higher and higher until finally they're about 10 feet high. You know, with bird cages and everything, growing trees and everything else. And everything gets extravagant. Everything gets Baroque. Y'all know what Baroque means?
It's different than broke.
No, not broke. That comes next, Paul. After Baroque comes broke. And so you get a Baroque age. You get a Gilded Age. Everything gets more and more complicated, extravagant, complex, and so on. What's the history of the American automobile up to now? You know, as we're going back to Volkswagen Model Ts and things like that, see? You get the more and more complex automobile. You look at some of our most complex automobiles, all you got to do is lift up the hood and look at that maze of wire machinery and everything else. You got half a dozen motors in there of one sort or another driving this, that, and the other thing.
Is that where the freedom of living comes in?
Yeah, but freedom is defined in terms of do your own thing. And as another characteristic of a do your own thing age is the fact that we get used to the unusual. See, something is unusual and novel. Then we get used to it. It's common. So then we want something more, something new. We generate a constant demand for something new, bigger bangs for the buck, you know, more complex things, more exciting things, so on. And also our military forces get that way. And they want more and more complex things.
Well, liberty is freedom without hurting the other fellow.
Yeah, but now you're giving a different definition of that.
But
that's not the way this kind of life would define it.
Well, then we forget.
This kind of life doesn't worry about the next fellow. Except as he may interfere with my having. See, this is a self-centered notion of freedom. Doing my own thing. Now, it may bring joy to me if you can do your own thing too, see. But you know, we don't do ethical things like Paul is doing right now and picking up your book for you, see. We may sit, you know, and as if Merle sitting here is at the aesthetical stage, he may look over and frown at you for disturbing his concentration by dropping your books, see.
Because he's so wrapped up in himself.
Well, because he's getting so many kicks out of what I've got to say. I may be getting kicked out of him getting kicked. It may make me feel very good. All right, but at any rate, the trouble with this kind of life is, number one, it's hard to sustain it. And I may not be able to afford it anymore. And so consequently, want to or not, I have to become ethical. I can't keep on having my kicks. I can't keep on waking up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and staying out half the night and coming back and going back in the sack. Sooner or later, my parents say to me, it's about time you go out and get a job. Right? So I become a 9-to-5 person. I become either real or apparently ethical. I fit in a system, and that's what we'll talk about next time. But I try as hard as I can to avoid getting committed. Now, Kierkegaard, there are two stories in Kierkegaard I want to refer you to, and both of them are in the Brethel book that I told you about. The one is called The Diary of the Seducer, and this is a rather long story, and it's about a young man who decides he's going to cause a young lady to fall in love with him. And he tells you all the complicated maneuvers and everything else that he goes through to get her to fall in love with him. She falls in love with him, they become engaged. His problem now is, how can I disconnect her? In other words, how can I avoid marriage, which is the ethical relationship? How can I avoid marriage? So then he disconnects her. And he does it in such a way that she thinks she's doing him a favor and that she has broken the engagement. This is the aesthetical life. The ethical life would be, it ends up with marriage. The aesthetical life, you don't get married, because that ties you down. The second one, I think, is called The Banquet. And it's a story of how a man arranged an evening for his friends at an inn out in the country. He tells them to be at a certain place at a certain time. They are taken into a carriage where the curtains are down on the windows. They can't see out. In other words, he divorces them from their everyday involvement in the stream of history. When they stop at the courtyard of this inn where they have never been before, the door is opened. They come in. There's nobody else there. It's been reserved for them. They're taken upstairs to the private dining room. As the door opens, orchestra strikes up playing Mozart, which is their favorite composer. And lights come on in the room, and they're the first courses. They walk in and they sit down. They're served. You know, there's no time pressures on anybody else. And when they reach the point where they have eaten just enough, drunk just enough, are just pleasantly relaxed, he tells them, the coachman is waiting at the door. He will take you to wherever you want to be taken. You know, evening's over. A perfectly planned evening. Aesthetical experience. The paradigm model, and you can think about this while you're having coffee break, the paradigm person whom Kierkegaard uses for the aesthete par excellence is Don Juan. See? The biggest enemy other than boredom for this kind of life is middle and old age, when it gets harder and harder to live this kind of life. But there are many people who try to live this kind of life. One of them happens to be the widow of a martyred president of the United States, and her friends. But the only people that are able to sustain it are wealthy people and bums. Bums. Here, you just drift. Okay? See you tomorrow.
Thanks, y'all. Okay.